Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 2. At 7 o'clock the next morning, I sat with another client on the floor of the small room my friend, veterinarian Tony Manini, had converted for my use in his clinic. Jay was 8 years old and learning disabled. The scars on his arm marked where a neighbor's dog had bitten him. As biting cases go, it was pretty typical. Kids sustain far more than their share of bites, boys get bitten more often than girls, and their own and their neighbor's dogs do most of the biting. This case wasn't typical, though, because unlike the majority of kids bitten, Jay then became very afraid of dogs. The school psychologist suspected that the bites were the last straw in a year that included his parents' divorce, a new home, and a new school. All that, plus not being able to read as well as the other kids. She wanted to know if Elizabeth and I could help. So here we were, and, for as often as Elizabeth seems determined to ruin me professionally with her behavior, she takes her job as a reading therapy dog very seriously. While Jay and I sat on the floor reading books to each other, she lay on her pillow on the opposite side of the room, with her big brown eyes glued on him. His slightest look in her direction caused her earplane ears to prick up, and her whole body to quiver in anticipation. But she didn't budge an inch. It had been like this for almost 2 months. One, sometimes two mornings a week, Jay's mom would drop him off at the clinic on her way to work, and he and I would read or talk while Elizabeth watched until it was time for me to drop him off at school. During our last meeting, he said that Elizabeth could ride to school with us if she stayed in the back seat of my old Saab, which she did. Today's session started out like all the others, except that Elizabeth wanted to give that child a dog lick more than ever. Had she possessed the necessary muscles and nerves to do so, I'm sure she would have curled her fat little toes around the edge of her pillow to keep herself from bouncing over to him. Everything about her radiated the same message. When? But I couldn't tell her when, because that was a question only Jay could answer. When the answer did come, at first it was so subtle that I missed it. But Elizabeth didn't. It began when Jay started periodically tapping his fingers on the floor beside him, keeping time with a poem I was reading about marching ants. Every time he did this, Elizabeth would prick up her ears. When he stopped, her ears would sag. Soon boy and dog were involved in a finger-tapping, ear-flapping game that made him forget his fears. Once I realized what was happening, I kept reading the same stanzas over and over again so I wouldn't break the tempo that sustained the game. Suddenly Jay laughed and called, "Elizabeth, come!" Elizabeth leaped to her feet, then froze and looked at me. I nodded and, in a gesture that canceled out all of her past dog sins and elevated her to the level of corgi sainthood, if such exists, which seems doubtful, she slowly crept toward him, gently laid her head in his lap, then sighed as if she'd died and gone to dog heaven when he began petting her. It doesn't get much better than that. But just to show you how crazy working with animals can make you, my benevolent feelings about Elizabeth experienced a complete reversal less than 2 hours later when I arrived home and grabbed the ringing phone at the same time I noticed my best pair of panties, minus the crotch, under the kitchen table. "You support a dangerous dog ordinance for Holderness County, Doc?" I stared at the chewed panties as the caller's words flowed into my ear. I wanted to say, "God, yes, especially if it includes a dangerous dog currently sitting on my foot. Off with their big-eared, pointy-nosed, undie-eating little head, I say." But because I expected the reporter from the Somerset Eagle to ask my views on barking coyotes, foraging bears, blanket-sucking cats, or some other animal behavior like he always did when he called, I merely said, "What?" "The dangerous dog ordinance. The one everyone's been talking about since that pit bull killed the woman running Joe Talbot's cottage." Jesus! It took several seconds for that news to register completely, but once it did, I managed to choke out a fairly normal-sounding, "What happened?" "Nobody knows much, beyond what's in this morning's paper," the reporter reported. The meter reader came round to do his thing and saw blood all over that big window Joe put in out back. Looked inside and saw the body with the dog standing over it, all covered with blood. When did it happen? I wondered if my voice sounded as strained to my caller as it did to me. The police say probably around 1 or 2 yesterday, give or take a couple hours. His comment gave me the perfect opportunity to exclaim, "My goodness, it must have been right after I left." But I didn't. Instead, I kept staring at those damned panties trying to harness my rampaging thoughts. "You there, Doc?" "What? Oh, sorry, I apologized. It's such a shock." "I know what you mean," the reporter sympathized. "Man's best friend and all that. That's why I wanted to know what you thought about the law." I told him that, as tragic as the death was, any proposed legislation should acknowledge that dangerous dogs come in all shapes and sizes, and not reflect any public panic regarding one particular dog of one particular breed. Fortunately, that satisfied him, and he hung up. A stream of curses poured out of me as I recalled leaving my unread newspaper at Tony's when I took Jay to school that morning. I let loose with another barrage 5 minutes later when I realized I'd filled the stoneware teapot with boiling water, but forgot to put the peppermint tea bag in the pot. I would have repeated the profane process a third time when I overfilled my cup and tea flowed across the kitchen table, but by then I didn't care, any more than I cared about Maddie and Elizabeth playing tug-of-war with the remnants of my undies. All I cared about was Monica, Sonko, and Harley. Only when old Teresa sighed loudly and glared at the corgi and the cat did I come to my senses. "It's no use," I told her with enough conviction to gain the attention of the undie shredders, too. "I have to get another copy of the paper." Although normally I would have driven to town for the newspaper, today I felt compelled to walk to the general store at the south end of Somerset Lake, the same route I'd driven the day before when I went to see Monica Sonko. This, I thought, would give me some time to compose myself. I had no idea what I intended to do after I read the paper, but the mere fact that I'd summoned the wherewithal to do anything made me feel more in control. By the time I reached the turnoff to the narrow, haphazardly maintained road that snaked through the woods surrounding the lake, I'd managed to slow my racing thoughts enough to begin making sense of them. Naturally, one in particular screamed for my attention. Harley couldn't have killed Monica. He couldn't have, I told myself over and over again. I'd stake my reputation on it. Hell, I did stake my reputation on it. I recalled the instant I made up my mind that the dog posed no danger to his owner based on what she had confided and my years of experience. Problem was, for the first time in my career, I had no notes to prove it. Only the report I wrote up from memory after the fact. What if I'd missed or forgotten something? "But they wouldn't blame you if the dog killed her," noted some reasonably calm inner voice. "She didn't call you because he was aggressive." "Be serious," I chastised the disembodied speaker. "I decided a tiny mouse of a woman was safe with a very large pit bull. A dog a lot of big brawny guys don't consider safe under any circumstances. Why wouldn't someone wonder why a person with my credentials and experience left her alone with that dog after what she told me? Why wouldn't someone hold me responsible for what happened?" Did I mention I often talk to myself as well as the pets? Well, I do. At a cocktail party I attended with a knee-sucking surgeon, I cautiously broached the subject with one of the other guests, a psychiatrist. He assured me that many people talk to themselves and that problems only arise when they think someone answers, which, he said, indicated a tenuous grasp on reality. However, the idea of talking to myself when no one talked back struck me as even more tenuous. Who in their right mind would do such a dumb thing? Unfortunately, I couldn't think of any way to ask him that without incriminating myself, so I do worry about my sanity occasionally, but not enough to let it interfere with my work. Right now, I was so concerned about my possible culpability in Monica Sonka's death, I would have talked to Elvis if he'd shown up in my head with some answers. But he didn't, and I had to settle for the usual nameless crew. "Why didn't the police contact me when they found the body?" I irritably addressed no one in particular. Surely even the most inexperienced officer would consider a business card belonging to a veterinary ethologist found in a room with a person killed by a dog a significant clue. And I distinctly remember handing Monica exactly such a card and watching her carefully place it in a small ceramic dish on the table beside her chair, for safekeeping. Maybe she moved the card. I proposed the explanation that seemed the most logical. Or maybe someone else took it before the police arrived. Some inner voice rendered its own, more ominous opinion. Ominous or not, that idea intrigued me, particularly in light of Monica's response to whoever, and I was pretty sure it was a whoever rather than a whatever, she saw through the window, who caused her to terminate our meeting so abruptly. On the other hand, if that someone both killed her and took my card, I found the idea of a murderer running around loose with my business card in his pocket a hell of a lot more creepy than intriguing. These worries all became inconsequential, though, after I bought a copy of The Eagle from the dispenser in front of the Somerset Lake General Store and read the front-page story of Monica Sonko's death. In keeping with the paper's long-on-gore, short-on-useful-facts policy, the text consisted primarily of a vivid description of how police officers shot the vicious killer dog when he lunged at them as they entered the cottage. This was interspersed with a smattering of person-on-the-street comments expressing outrage about pit bulls in general and Harley in particular. The opinion of the pathologist who examined the dead woman's body appeared more like an afterthought at the end. That authoritative source expressed the utmost certainty that the dog had brutally killed his owner. "There's no mention of you. Your career's safe," stupidly crowed yet another disembodied voice. "If that dog killed her, my career isn't safe." I viciously kicked a small rock in the road, since I obviously couldn't kick the idiot in my head. If I misread him that badly, I shouldn't be in the damn business. "So what are you gonna do?" replied the same voice somewhat peevishly. "Go turn yourself in?" "Sort of." I automatically tugged on a clump of gray and curls, a habit of mine when I'm bothered. "I'm going to tell the police that Harley didn't kill Monica, and that they have to find out who really did. And they'll just ignore their instincts and those post-mortem findings and hop right to it?" Every time someone in my head says something irritating like that, I wonder if talking to myself is such a good idea. I wanted to tell the voice that, of course, the police would hop right to it, but I knew they probably wouldn't. Either they'd dismiss my remarks as those of an overreacting, poor, strange, possibly reclusive cat shrink, and I'd spend the rest of my life wallowing in self-doubt, or they'd focus any investigation on my incompetence rather than the true identity of Monica's killers, in which case I'd spend the rest of my life unloading cat food at Walmart. Granted, I deserved to be investigated if that dog really killed her, but I had no intention of submitting to that until I was damn sure that the murder had been thoroughly investigated first. Even though I'd kept walking while I processed these thoughts, it still surprised me to find myself at the entrance of the long driveway to Joe Talbot's cottage. Fueled by the slim hope that just seeing the scene again would enable me to recall some critical detail I'd forgotten, I made my way toward the place where Monica Sonko and her dog had died. The sight of Somerset Lake itself did nothing to bolster my spirits. Although New Hampshire can boast numerous bodies of sparkling glacial waters, Somerset Lake wasn't one of them. Stained by the tannic acid of rotting trees and thickened by an erratic current that worried its waters and left a skim of debris around its perimeter, it looked like a large spill of stale tea. The scattering of worn cottages with cracked and chipped paint that dotted its shores like overturned cups from an abandoned tea set completed the image. I paused and studied Joe's better-than-average dwelling while I determined the best way to approach it. Today it looked far more sinister than welcoming, an effect heightened by the trampled plants in the flower bed encircling it. After taking a few deep breaths to steady myself, I moved quickly to the back of the cottage, feeling far too much like a criminal returning to the scene of a crime than I found comfortable. For a long time I just stood there, staring at the murky brown lake's reflection in the blood-smeared glass. "Hey, you!" I instinctively tried to pull away as a firm hand clamped my shoulder. "Cinny!" Surprise replaced anger as Joe Talbot thankfully recognized me. "What are you doing here?" I slapped on my most innocent expression while fear and shock vied for the honor of tying my intestines into the largest knot. "Just wanted to see where it happened, Joe." I volunteered the half-truth somewhat breathlessly, then immediately changed the subject to a safer one. "How's Eleanor?" Joe's ruddy, weather-beaten features softened instantly. "'Twasn't as bad as we thought, but she'll be in the hospital for a few more days. He looked at his watch, then at the cottage, and then at me. "I was going to stop by your place on my way to see her to find out how to get rid of bloodstains," he continued sheepishly. "Eleanor made one of them rag rugs of hers for the cottage last winter and forgot all about it till right before she got sick. Made me promise to drop it off on my way to work yesterday." He shook his head ruefully, a gesture which, when coupled with his stubby, pear-shaped body and great shock of white hair, made him look like an Irk druid. Add his thick New Hampshire accent and the idea that at least one local druid had mated with one local human in the distant past didn't seem that unlikely. "Wouldn't you know that it'd be worse you'd..." He pressed his lips tightly together rather than verbalize the unpleasant fact that Monica Sonko had died on his wife's handiwork. "I got a professional cleaning service coming out to clean the place soon as they can, but I know Eleanor'd want me to take care of the rug myself." Joe glanced at his watch again, and I sensed his eagerness to visit his ailing spouse. Considering how many times I'd removed bloodstains during my years in veterinary medical practice, I didn't hesitate to volunteer for that particular job. He smiled broadly in relief, but his features dimmed when he drew a key out of his pocket and turned toward the cottage. "Go see Eleanor." I immediately took the key from him when I realized he had no desire to enter the building. "I'll get the rug." "You sure you don't mind? Seems like you got enough on your plate since Bob died." "You were there when I needed you. You and Eleanor," I reminded him, giving him a gentle shove toward the driveway. "Besides, it'll give me something to do. Take my mind off things." I felt totally deceitful for making that pitiful reference to Bob's death when it was the last thing on my mind at the moment. But I knew it would strike a responsive chord because Eleanor Talbot had recently suffered a coronary from which she, unlike Bob, would recover. Although I do occasionally miss Bob and probably ought to devote more time to all those Bob-related issues still on my plate, concern about Monica Sonko's death left no room for such thoughts now. Until the sound of Joe's old Jeep faded completely, I stood on the deck and stared at the bloody paw print stippling the lower two-thirds of the large window and the glass-paneled door beside it. When only the cries of a few distant crows filled the air, I unlocked the door and entered the familiar room. In spite of a valiant attempt to block the image, as soon as I saw the dried blood on the floor and walls immediately in front of me, I could picture the police opening fire on Harley when he lunged at them. On the other side of the room, another large stain on a variegated rag rug and the dull splatters on the wall and furnishings nearby marked the spot where Monica Sonko had died. If all that weren't depressing enough, the small ceramic dish on the end table next to the chintz-covered chair gaped at me emptily. "Well, now what?" I complained to the empty room. I suspected the damn card was gone, and sure enough it is. Because this line of thought again raised the troubling specter of Monica Sonko's killer taking it, I decided to make a quick tour of the cottage to prove that Monica had moved my business card herself. The instant I closed her bedroom door to look on the end of the bureau behind it, though, I forgot all about the card. A lattice of fresh, deep scratches that almost completely covered the back side of the door leaped out at me. Someone had shut a dog in there, and the dog didn't like it at all. Feeling somewhat cheered by this discovery, I then opened the door to the small laundry room next to the bedroom. When I did, a familiar odor immediately caught my attention. Urine. Monica's adamant assurance that Harley would rather die than mess in the house immediately popped into my mind. When I located the puddle on the floor behind the laundry room door, my memory of the pit bull's insecure but macho attitude, combined with what his owner told me about his elimination habits, further confirmed that the urine wasn't his. Harley was a full-time leg lifter, and no leg lifter would leave such a neat pool. I ran my index finger through the liquid, rubbed it between my fingers and thumb, and smelled it. It didn't feel or smell like dog urine either. After rummaging through several drawers in the kitchen, I located a small container and a basting syringe, collected a sample of the urine, and slipped it into the pocket of my windbreaker. Then I got down on my hands and knees and examined every inch of the laundry room floor. Even if I hadn't noticed the slightly damp mop leaning against the wall, the swirling smears on the worn vinyl clearly indicated that someone had made a hasty attempt to clean the area. A clue to why someone would do this took the form of a small oval manure pellet and a few wisps of hay I found trapped between the washer and dryer. Monica Sonko had kept some kind of animal in there, probably a sheep or a goat. But why would she take a sheep or goat on vacation with her? That question elicited such a raft of bizarre images I couldn't even go there. Instead, I jettisoned them all in favor of another question. Why hadn't I heard the animal when I was here? Because it wasn't here, I told myself, popping the pellet into a plastic bag I found in another kitchen drawer. Well, then where the hell was it? Thinking my client may have put her unorthodox pet outdoors during my visit, I scanned the area immediately around the cottage. Only the trampled perennial bed I'd noticed when I approached the cottage looked amiss. When I'd first glanced at it, I'd assumed that the police had caused the damage. But when I surveyed the scene more carefully, I easily dismissed that possibility. The narrow bed in no way obstructed entry into the cottage, and surely the police wouldn't bother looking there for evidence of a dog who allegedly had killed someone inside. A familiar pattern in the soil around the trampled perennials and small shrubs behind them immediately sent my thoughts spinning off in another direction. Who would bother raking a bed without moving all the damaged plants in it? Certainly no gardener like Joe or Ellen or Talbot. Once more I got down on my hands and knees, this time beside the carefully raked but otherwise bedraggled border. After carefully assessing the damage, I concluded that an animal had chewed as well as trampled the flowering plants and gnawed the bark off some of the shrubs. The animal's eating habits made me think I was dealing with a little goat rather than a sheep. When I brushed away the dead leaves the wind had piled near the plank steps leading up to the front door of the cottage, I found more droppings and several small cloven hoof prints, and a little one at that. I scooped more pellets into the plastic bag and stuffed it back into my pocket with my other treasures. Next, I examined each plant and shrub carefully, all traces of apprehension replaced by curiosity that intensified enormously when I discovered a spattering of reddish-brown stains on the underside of a cluster of white daisies. Blood. This discovery so engrossed me that, when a twig snapped like a gunshot somewhere in the woods immediately surrounding the cottage, I leaped to my feet, then hurriedly scrubbed my hands on my jeans in an effort to remove all evidence of my activities. My racing pulse slowly returned to normal when I saw nothing but the shadowy form of a dog angling through the thick undergrowth toward the lake. I continued exploring. A quick circuit around the cottage revealed a nearly new rake with several oak leaves bearing those same reddish-brown spatters impaled on its tines. When I carefully removed these, a small piece of skin and adjacent tissue trapped between the leaves fell to the ground. I picked it up carefully and examined its pelt of medium-length, intermingled dark and light hairs. Animal rather than human, and definitely not from Harley, and more likely from a goat than a sheep. Feeling I'd collected more than enough evidence to convince the police to investigate Monica Sonko's death more thoroughly, I locked the cottage and headed for home. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery, written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.